As promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you. Update for Brisbane, Australian True Crime fans. Brisbane is almost fully sold out for our live show. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well. So, you know, we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian true crime live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests. So please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children, and it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
More failings in the youth justice system have been laid bare as two boys face sentencing for murder, including the youngest in Queensland history. Angus Beaumont was stabbed in the heart at Redcliffe by teenagers on probation for other crimes.
Our guest today is Michelle Little. In February this year, she watched for the second time as two teenagers fought for their freedom after taking the life of her 15-year-old son, Angus, in a Brisbane park in 2020. They were aged just 13 and 14 at the time of the lethal stabbing. One was on bail for armed robbery and the other was on probation. They both had significant histories of violent assaults. But even though Angus's final moments were captured on CCTV, the boys successfully appealed their initial convictions for his stabbing death and won a retrial. That judge-only trial began in December 2023 and ended with one of the boys being found guilty of murder and the other guilty of manslaughter. They were sentenced to 9 years and 6 years respectively. However, each of them is expected to serve around half of those sentences. I spoke to Angus's mum, Michelle Little, from her home in Redcliffe in Brisbane's outer north, which is a suburb I know very well, having lived there myself when my children were babies.
That night, I was even talking to hubby the other night, and I said, I can't even remember whether I picked him up, Ben picked him up, or he rode his bike home that night. But I remember his new laptop showed up and his new skateboard. His brother had given him his old motorbike because Angus was signing up for a small engines and a business course through school. He'd sort of hit that hormonal teen stage where we had been having a bit of trouble getting him to school. And also, he'd just broken up with his girlfriend and gone into this big, it's the end of the world for boys, and he'd gone into this big, deep depression, and we're just trying to bring him back up and everything else. But yeah, he decided he wasn't going to work on the motorbike anymore because he tried and he got his brother's friends in to help, and there was going to be too hard getting certain parts and doing it. So he was told he was allowed to sell it if that was what he wanted to do. So like I said, he ordered these things, a new hoodie, some shoes, a laptop and skateboard. The laptop and skateboard showed up that afternoon, and he'd already got on board trying to set it up. He'd already been in contact with his mates. You know, I'm running a bit behind school. He was actually grounded that week. It was heartbreaking because we thought we were being so hard on him. And he was a good kid. And he worked. He worked at all school holidays and that with his father. And, you know, he'd been working since he was so little. And we thought, oh, look, we hummed and hawed about letting him go because he was only just starting to be allowed out, you know, at night. He was a nerdy on his computer all the time, and I actually felt bad because I said, you've got to get out and see your friends and not just living in your room. God, after we lost him, you know, the guilt of that, like saying to him that he needed to, you know, socialise more. I wish I'd never, but yeah, that night he come to me and he said, Mum, you know, I want to go to Picnic Hill and, you know, with the food trucks that they have up here near the skate park. And I, you know, done that thing like mums do, I was rushing around and grabbing stuff, and our washing machine had broken, so I was putting washing together and I was going to go over to the neighbours and do it till we could organise repairs. And I said to him, Angus, who are you going with? You're not going till you tell me who you're going with. And we were having a discussion, but then I was on the phone as well, and he was talking and asking me, Mum, can we go shopping for food? You know, nothing stuff. Anyway, I hopped off the phone and said, look, I'll come back and talk to you, and you can tell me who you plan to go with, and we'll work out times. I said, you can't be home any later than 9. You've got work with Dad in the morning. He had a 6 o'clock start. And I said, you either can do Uber or bus, but you have to call us or we'll pick you up. But I said, you have to check in at 9 o'clock. And I said, that's once I find out who you're going with. And I said, I'll be back. And anyway, I went across the road, took washing across, and of course you get talking with the neighbour. Half an hour later, I come back, and teenage boys being teenage boys, he already got ready, he grabbed his new skateboard, and he'd gone to Dad for that second, you know, opinion. And, you know, talked to his father and probably told Ben, Mum said I could go, you know, and got $50 off his dad for food and bus or Uber, and I come home, and he was already gone. I caught sight of, you know, Angus going around the corner. I thought out the corner of my eye, but I wasn't sure. But I spoke to his father, and he'd said, that, you know, he'd given him money and how to talk to him, but that was a dad talk, not a mum talk.
Yeah.
And we just went about our afternoon, and hubby sort of, because he gets up, you know, real early for work. So I was, you know, just doing whatever you do as a mum, you know, things around the house. TV was on. I wasn't really watching it. I kept hearing the phone ring, and Ben's phone ring, and he wasn't answering it because he thought it was just spam, just, you know, the usual telemarketers and things. And, you know, it got to like 8:55, and as a mother, you always, that lead up to that checking time, you're like, especially when they're just starting to go out, I couldn't wait. So I jumped the gun and I was ringing, and he didn't answer, and ringing again going, Angus, you've got to answer me. Pick up your phone. And then messaging and say, please call. Ben, while I was on the phone, he finally picked up the call and answered it. And all I heard was, what do you mean he's in recess? And I ran to the room, you know, and said, what's going on? And he goes, we've got to get to the hospital. Angus is hurt. They won't tell me much. And he's in recess. And I don't know why, but I knew it was horrendous. The thought, like, recess, and you hear that and you don't think anything good. I grabbed things. I grabbed stupid things that I didn't even need. I didn't know what to do. And we bundled up our youngest, and Ben ran him across the road to our neighbours and our friend, and we asked her if she could watch him. We got in the car, and I was telling Ben to drive carefully, just drive carefully. And then by the end of it, I'm screaming at him, don't wait for the lights, just go, just go. And we got to the hospital and we ran from the car. We actually left the car on, doors open. The battery went flat because we just left it there, and ran to emergency doors, and a nurse met us at the door, and it was like the world just slowed down. I can't even describe it. And we were taken to a room and asked to sit there and wait, and it felt like hours. I was losing it. I just kept saying, I want to see him, I want to see him. And then a group of like nurses and I don't know, a doctor, I couldn't see, I still can't remember faces from that night, bar the nurse that was at the end of Angus's bed. But they came in and they were talking, and I see Ben's reaction, but you just can't take it all in. You're in shock. And then we were left again to wait, I think, for police were doing, taking prints and doing whatever. But I it sounds crazy, but I started, you just, it's like, I can't explain, you're so frustrated and you just want to go. And I started actually rocking and just hitting my head, and, you know, you don't even realize what you're doing on the back wall because you're going into some sort of shock. And when we walked out of the room and the police, you know, said they need to speak to someone, and Ben went with them, my daughter arrived up at the hospital, thank God, and she came and sat in with me because Ben just walked in and walked out. He just couldn't. He couldn't. To see his son there like that was just too much. And I just couldn't register that you just, as a parent, you know, your child's alive and full of energy, you know, off on their skateboard to the bus stop, to, you know, they're going to be home and you're just waiting. As a mother, you're waiting, you know, you just want them back home. I tried to open his eyes and I just begged him to breathe. I'm so grateful for my daughter She's had to be a tower of strength, and it, you know, that's been a lot for her as well and changed who she is. My older children are adults, and so Rhiannon, she was in her late 20s. She'd only ever had like one loss, and that was her auntie on her father's side, which we all adored. And that was sad. But
it's not like this. There's nothing like
nothing like this.
Loss to violence.
It's not the same. And look, I've been through a lot of loss in my lifetime, as my family has. Not so much Ben. It was cruel because it was his first loss. And it was the cruelest kind of the worst loss. Your parents, it's that thing that you know they're going to go before you.
Yeah, it's the natural way.
It is. You got to have an opportunity to say all the things you want to say and hug them and comfort them. And, you know, we had that right stolen from us. And as a parent, that guilt of not being there to comfort your child, protect your child, like you would have took the blade for them, like, you know. Especially when it's your child, you're condemned to feeling that guilt that you dropped the ball. You know, your one job was to protect your child, and you failed. And that's heartbreaking to have to live with. People say, oh, you know, you can't feel guilt, but oh, God, yes, you do. And it's been you are. You just are going to feel guilt regardless of whatever anyone says. I'll go back a little bit just quickly with the hospital. The reason why the police didn't actually come and see us like they usually would.
Okay, yes, to pick you up and take you to the hospital.
Well, I don't know if they pick you up, but to let us know. The head ED nurse that night was actually a friend of Ben's. He'd worked with her at hospital. I'd met her, she was lovely, and Angus had met her and worked at her home. So she knew who Angus was. And she had the hospital social worker get straight on the phone and start calling us.
So she identified him when he came in?
Oh, yeah, she knew who he was straight up. But like I said, when the number was coming up, it's just a private number.
Absolutely. I don't answer them at night either. You're waiting for his number to pop up.
That's exactly right. So, you know, I never held anything against her. She went straight into trying to get hold of us. But I seen that failing in the system where, you know, the number needed to come up as the hospital, as an emergency number. And, you know, for us, that was another hard thing was even if Angus, and it took us a long time to find out whether he was alive or dead on arrival, because when they're over 14, you can't have their medical history. So you can't be told anything about what happened. Yes, yep. Can't be. We had to apply for his medical history, and I don't think we've even got it fully yet. But, you know, that was a thing for us that we weren't there straight away. Again, that was another thing we had to live with. We were given a pack by police. He was asked questions. Ben himself had to actually come in and be interviewed so he could be crossed out as being any part of this.
So they didn't know. They didn't know on the night, the police.
On the night, they had an inkling, I guess, but, you know, and they got straight on the next day to finding out. So no, on the night there, if I'd have been on Facebook, I would have seen all these things. I would have actually found out before we'd even answered that phone that Angus was gone.
Wow. So the kids, the Bush Telegraph of Facebook or whatever social media they were on, was running hot that night.
And I think even a news reporter came out already. The next day after, you know, we lost Angus, like we were just in shock. And Kelly at 12 year old, unbeknownst to me, while I was still trying to come to grips and organise things, and we had everything and everyone coming at us at once. He was on his brother's computer trying to find out what happened to his brother that night, which friends were with his brother. and why they left his brother to die. And that's what he was asking Angus's friends, you know, who was with him, and why did you leave him to die? And that broke my heart. There was people, because we had to sift through all this eventually, that had said things, but no, on the night we didn't know. I did ask Ben again, you know, recently, how long was it till we went in, you know, in to speak to police, until we spoke to them. And it was on the following, it happened on the Friday, we went in on the Monday, and that's when we started getting more of an idea of the who. You know, we read some stuff, we knew, you know, how he'd been stabbed. But what people don't understand is, even after we went in to speak to police, they can tell you what's happened to your child. They've been stabbed, they've been killed, there's been two offenders involved, but they can't tell you anything else because they're juveniles. We had people accusing us of lying because we weren't telling them everything. We didn't know everything. We couldn't have anything. It's like you had to go home and live with that. And the police were so apologetic. And it's so awful for them because you're just there begging for anything, any information. And they're bound by legislation that states that they cannot tell you anything to do with these youth cases. We actually spoke to five different people who'd been attacked by these boys eventually, and they couldn't even see what was happening.
And yet at the same time, you've got social media running hot with kids gossiping. Oh,
there were so many variations of what happened. And, of course, you know, you had these boys knew all the local crims, so all of them are coming into bat and, you know, spreading rumours and lies and just malicious stuff and everything else. And it was, oh, my God, it was like we'd stepped off into this whole other world. And, you know, it was like a punch to the chest every time you had to read some of this stuff that was being written. And then, like I said, there was two different camps. There was one lot that were, oh, you're trash people because this happened to your child and your child must have been trash. And then there was this other camp that had empathy and sympathy and felt for you and were compassionate and just wanted to try and support you in any way they could. And we're so thankful for them, for the second lot who did stand by us and did support us. But the other crowd, they made this so much more traumatic and painful.
It's so hard to believe that anyone could not have compassion for you. Whatever rumour touch there is, it's so hard to believe that anyone could be uncompassionate, whatever the word is, for a family that loses a 15-year-old child.
I mean, look, I didn't even go after and rubbish these people in their thing. I just couldn't understand how they could do what they were doing, but it is, we call it opposite day. Criminals and offenders, they, you know, they see themselves as the victims and the victim as the one who's made their life miserable. And so it's that opposite day thought. And the other thing is that there is a lot of victim blaming. In the last 10 to 15 years, we've gone from a society that has a lot of compassion to a society that still has compassionate people, but there are so many willing to victim blame. And I've come to the realization that's out of vulnerability and fear. They feel like if they can, in their own mind, justify that this person deserved it in some way, that it was their own fault, that makes them feel more protected and less vulnerable. Like if they just do the right thing, this type of horrible violence or crime won't ever touch them or their family.
Charlie Bazina said something really interesting to me recently. He's, you know, the former homicide copper. So he's sat through a lot of court cases And he said to me that he believes that in every homicide case, there should be a big photograph of the victim just sitting there in the courtroom for the whole case. Because really simply, he said, and I think this goes double for youth offenders, because he said throughout the whole case, we can't hear about their previous crimes or their previous, any of their previous charges or any of their previous activity, really. But especially through sentencing, their defense is going to talk up their childhood, all of the extenuating circumstances in their lives. Their whole job is to make us feel very sorry and feel a lot of empathy for the offender.
Oh, absolutely.
We don't hear a lot about the victim. We don't hear a lot about the victim's childhood, the victim's life, and especially, you know, and I'm not talking about the victim's childhood being wanting or being unhappy. I mean, just about the person who's been lost and their family. And we get the victim impact statements. We get that one opportunity, and that's a fairly new thing in Australia as well, but that one opportunity for people to talk about the victim. But he makes the point that the victim can be lost in the process, and that's just in the judicial system. But I think your case is a really good example of Angus's story being lost, and also the story of the offenders and who they are and have been up to this fatal attack being lost. But we hear about their troubled childhoods, and we hear about all the reasons why we need to have empathy for them. And so what is left is the rumor mill about who Angus might have been, who you guys might have been, who they might have been. And there's a lot of filling in by other people.
Well, actually, on that note, that is one thing we were made aware of very early on by a few people. We were lucky enough to come across certain people, that a criminologist was one of them. My daughter's stepsister actually worked in a legal firm at one stage, and so she actually went and picked, you know, some of the lawyers' brains on this sort of stuff. And early on we knew we had to make Angus visible, and we had to tell his story openly and publicly. Just when you want to be guarded and just when you want to run away and hide and lock down, we had to make people understand this is a human being. Our child was a person. He was, you know, a boy with a life ahead of him. You know, he got into his high school on like excellence program for math, science and English. He was like, we laugh and we used to call him Big Kev because he was always so excited, you know. He wanted to experience and do everything. You know, like I said, if we went somewhere on holidays, he'd want to try everything, taste everything, you know, get out there on the track and do this. And he'd be encouraging his little brother to, come on, Kelly, let's do this. And, you know, and so, you know, we had to open our lives up and open Angus's life up and humanize him. But that was straight up, we were told, you're not going to get that in court. You're not going to, the defense is going to try and make your son look like a thug. They're going to try and just bury him in dirt. You're going to have to work double hard to get out who Angus was and, you know, have him represented in his case, because what the defense try and do in cases like this is there's what's called thug-on-thug violence. They want to make the victim look like they were just as bad as the offenders that dealt the blow. And, you know, Angus was such a polar opposite of these kids, such a polar opposite. So straight up, like, you know, originally I got a page up that was more for my family and friends to, because they couldn't be at the funeral and, you know, the little video link in the corner just didn't cut it and nobody could see photos or whatever. But 7 months in, Ben had put up the justice page, and yeah, we really, it was a labour of love and a job and heart, a labour of heartache as well. We had to put Angus out there and we had to fight defense as every action to dehumanize our son, and It is really an eye-opener to see just how much free reign defence has. And this is the thing that people don't understand publicly. When the newspaper is printing what defence said, what was said in court, they don't understand that defence is literally making up scenarios. It's legal lies. They're allowed to make up whatever this big story is.
Trying to create that element of doubt. It's all about it. Yeah,
that's their job. That is their job. And see, people take that as gospel.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
What do you know of what happened on the night? Because from what I can figure out, from what you've told me, Angus was at the park like 2 hours. What do you know that happened?
Well, look, he went down to meet this group of kids. One of them had only been living in Redcliffe 6 months, the other 9 months, and he'd already been banned from our house because, you know, mothers, you're vetting, you know. And the other girl I didn't really know well, Angus knew her from primary and that, and she was going to a different school to him locally, but he sort of got drawn into this group after his little heartache and depression, and he wasn't even with his normal circle of friends that night. And some of them either weren't going or couldn't go. So he's met up with this group. Now, he was waiting at McDonald's, and we know this only because we, like I said, scoured through everything. Like for months after we lost Angus, we would stay up night and day where we were, you know, pacing the floor like lunatics or laying there crying. And, you know, we managed to find from his phone where he walked and that sort of thing. But so he was waiting for them at McDonald's, and, you know, we seen he set these little SpongeBob beams, you know, we're fine, I'm really bored sitting here. And they messaged him and met him up, and they went to 7-Eleven, and then they went back over to the park. Now, this is something I'm trying to remember, but I think that group had met before they met up with Angus. I think they'd met up with those two boys, and apparently there was conversation about getting weed, and one of the boys had weed. And anyway, they met up with Angus after that, and then they went back to the park. Now, what's happened there is, like I said, you know, we sat in the court and they lined the thing here, and we're shown where they went from here to there and walked back. And somehow, like, these kids, and Angus was with them at this stage, but not with them. He stayed back with the girl. And these kids, like, I'm not saying he didn't know what was going on. As a parent, you know, I can't understand how he didn't come home once he knew what was going on. That was my first thing, was like, oh my God, you're in shock. You're in shock. You're like, how the hell did he end up in that situation that is totally foreign to him? How the hell? And, you know, like, apparently when they did meet him, actually going back, when they met him over at McDonald's. Now, this is, like I said, as a parent, you know, you expect your kids to have like an older head on their shoulders than they do have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And now this boy tried to get Angus to take a knife at McDonald's, and you could see him, no way. He's like, no way. But this kid's given him knuckle dusters instead, and Angus has put them in their pockets. I'm guessing, assuming, I don't want to take that weapon, I'm not, all right, fine, I'll just put them in, I'll, you know. And like I said, me as a parent, I'm thinking, why didn't you call us? Why didn't you come home? Why didn't you get up and leave? You knew better than this. You know, you were a smart kid.
Well, he probably, I mean, obviously he assumed, I'm assuming that he thought nothing violent was going to happen. I mean, it's one thing to be wandering around Redcliffe with a knuckle duster, or even wandering around with a guy who's got a knife, but I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, I say, I'm a person who lived in Redcliffe for years, and I was not assuming teenagers were wandering around Maccas with knives in their pockets. I did not think that was happening.
No. Look, you know, here's the thing is, like I said, with Angus, he was that big, goofy, nerdy kid that he got picked on because he was big and tall and smart, and it was so out of character.
But it sounds and it reads like, when I read reports about it, as though he was literally, and I can understand how, as a parent, when you say it, you may have felt like other people were going, sure, love.
Yeah, but absolutely.
It definitely reads as though this was a kid caught up in a fight.
He was out of his depth. And
yeah.
Look, like I said, they ended up, they went over there, that boy and the other boy were near the bathroom, and that's apparently where it all went down. And then what's unfolded is, like I said, these boys have made a deal. Angus was way back somewhere with this girl, and these boys made this deal. Then all of a sudden, knives were drawn, and, you know, these two boys that were wanting to buy weed were saying, they had a third person there, a mate that they'd got to bring down money. Then, you know, that group set off after the two boys out of Angus's group, and all the kids ran off. Angus stayed with the girl and went with her away. They actually hid behind a bush, and I'm watching this as a mother in court. And you're knowing that, you know, the end of this is your child dies, but you're still sitting there thinking, please don't come out from behind there. But he stayed with the girl. The two offenders pursued these other kids with blades out. Now, they say there's some question of that, but I'm blind. I've got glasses on, and I still can see these big blade the main offender had, and the smaller blade the other offender had, and they're walking towards this boy. He's got the bag held out, telling them he'll give them the bag if they'll just go away. But he didn't drop it. He just, I don't know whether what he was thinking, but he walked backwards. He ended up back up near the front footpath along the side of the road near the bus stop. Angus has heard him coming and stuck his head out to see, like, what's going on? And with that, he's passed Angus a knife, and you see Angus hold it up to look at it. And then these boys are just meters away, and he steps forward and tells them to, excuse my French, fuck off. And then steps back and puts that down behind his leg. And the thing was, the only time that ever came up again, and this is what police said, they knew Angus never attempted to use that blade. He didn't want to use that blade. Was when he kicked, it came across him like across the front of his chest. Because, you know, when you counterbalance and lift your foot up. So these boys have just launched on Angus. It was not a fight. He asked them to F off, go away. They just were on him like just pack animals. If you've ever seen two wolves coming at prey, one was behind him at the back on the side, one was in front of him, and they were just, it all happened within seconds. Angus was gone. The boy from the front was stabbing. He at one point nicked Angus on the chest. I don't know whether it went through his clothing, but you see Angus step back and grab his clothing. And then Angus has thrown a punch.
So are you saying there's CCTV of this? Have you seen video of this?
I've watched my son's death.
My God.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've watched it, but I didn't get up and leave because as a mother, you never want to see that, but as a mother, I have to know what happened to my child in his last moments. I have to know everything, good, bad, ugly, brutal, cruel. I have to know because it's the stuff you don't know that keeps you awake at night. You know, and this is where I think it's an absolute cruelty that victims' families aren't giving as much information as they get them to sign a legal waiver that they can't talk till after court. But everything they don't know is what eats away at them and sees them having nightmares and, you know, just it's trauma. And but, you know, that boy, the other boy was behind Angus, and he knew Angus was distracted, and he knew Angus was out of his depth. You can literally see the fear in Angus. And this boy has come from the back and the side, and he stabbed him. He just stabbed that blade straight from his back and went out and went through to Angus's chest. I couldn't work out why there was two wounds when we got the coroner's report, but that was from the blade going through. And then in flashes of a night, we started remembering later on, like, cuts across my son's hand where he'd obviously tried to grab the blade from the other boy to stop it. You know, and but it all happened so quickly, even having watched that video so many times. It's just over in seconds. In seconds, you're, you know, and like I said, as Angus fell, this boy tried to stab him again as he fell, the main offender. And then they slapped hands and they skipped off.
Do you mean as in high five?
Well, they slapped hands together, like, job well done. But that lost the first trial because the judge in the first trial used high five, even though he was telling the jury to not take the high five into account.
So not see that as a celebratory moment after the stabbing?
Yeah, when they're deliberating to not take that into account. That was one of the crux that they used to win the appeal, the fact that he'd even mentioned it.
Good evening. Heartbroken and frustrated. That's how the family of slain Redcliffe teenager Angus Beaumont is feeling after learning the reason why their son's alleged killers had their guilty verdicts overturned.
A year ago, two teenage boys were found guilty of his murder, sentenced to detention terms that would have seen them released before their 21st birthdays. Both appealed their convictions and won, the Court of Appeal today revealing why. The trial judge's directions caused a miscarriage of justice, agreeing the jury should have been given clear instructions about an alleged hand slap by the teens after Angus was stabbed, an issue central to the Crown case.
So they got every sort of benefit of the legal system thrown their way. You know, if the boys were holding up court and for an hour because they didn't want to come in because they didn't want to wear their greens from detention, or they didn't like the cutlery they were given to eat their breakfast with, or didn't like the breakfast, and they couldn't get them in for an hour while we're all sitting there, the first judge would actually not tell the jury what was happening and bring them in afterwards. So they wouldn't, you know, be prejudiced against the boys. And then when you hear things like there was information that was disallowed for the trial, the first trial, because it would be too prejudiced against the offenders. It, you know, basically the jury would have no other way to find them guilty. So that evidence is not allowed in court. Now, how does that make sense? That some condemning evidence, because it's too condemning, too prejudiced, is not allowed to be heard.
Again, it's difficult, isn't it, to, I'm not going to say understand, because we're not stupid, we understand it. It's difficult to accept.
Yes, yeah.
We have character witnesses, again, in the sentencing phase to give good character references, but this information that would obviously be negative character information, it must be excluded.
It's not a workable system. It really isn't a workable system. These two boys, now, the first judge who let them out on bail before Angus's murder for a series of violent offences, now, they were already big into their little criminal career by the ages of 12, whatever. But when they took Angus's life, look, they were 14. I think one was actually turning 14.
Oh, okay. So 14 was the elder.
Yeah, yeah.
13 and 14.
But, you know, the judge had let them out in the somewhere in between October and January. They were held in detention for other violent offences. They were then given bail and they then went on to commit more offences even before taking Angus's life. And then in the March, they took Angus's life. And then, you know, after being held for, I think it was it 18 months or less, they were bailed again. We actually fought really hard to be in because I said, you know, like I said, we were trying to get any information and every bit of information. We actually had to apply for each process leading up to the trial and all other things like bail. We actually had to put in a letter of application to the head justice each time we wanted to participate in these. So we were actually there at the main offender's bail and we heard his address. We heard all these other information that we didn't realise his criminal past. That all came out. And so we were blown away by some of the stuff.
The ABC has reported that the main offender had previously approached a woman pushing a pram in Redcliffe and threatened to kill her baby.
Actually, that boy was the other
boy. That was the other one. That wasn't the main offender.
But the one who wasn't the main offender, he was, look, he is actually much more violent. Like you were saying, he held a knife to a baby and threatened to kill it if the mother didn't hand over money. He also set fire to the youth space at one stage. All these other things, the list just went on.
And these two boys tried to claim self-defence.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. And that Angus scared them because he was so big and tall and fit that he scared them. And I watched that video and there was only one person scared. And that was Angus. He was out of his depth. He just wanted them to go away. He was trying to protect the other two kids behind him.
The verdict in a retrial of two teenage boys accused of murdering Redcliffe teen Angus Beaumont has been described by his family as the best of the worst set of outcomes.
Both teens were convicted of murder by a jury in June last year and were sentenced to 9 years and 7 years jail, respectively. In May, they appealed and won and faced a retrial earlier this month. The younger boy who inflicted the fatal wound was again found guilty of murder, the other guilty of manslaughter.
When these boys were both let on out on bail, they came straight back here. They both came straight back here. One south side, but the other's got family south side and family over this side. I was actually walking past the main killer's family home to get to my counsellor after losing Angus. And, you know, felt so vulnerable when I found out. There's not a lot out there when you step into this. You're sort of thrown in a deep end and you either sink or you swim, and you know, you've got to try and get your head above water and, you know, find resources as you're up to it and as you can. We do have Queensland Homicide Victim Support Group.
I was just going to ask you about that. I don't think I've met anyone from that group, but I've certainly had a lot to do with the Victorian group and a little to do with the New South Wales group, and they're brilliant.
And look, I will tell you, you know, say 6 weeks in, we were in a car and they rang, and Ben, apparently they'd rang Ben before me and he didn't want to deal with any of that, being, like I said, men do this differently. And I actually said to him, look, I'm not ready at the time, but when I am. And look, I will tell you, like, the first person I did speak to, well, not the first, sorry, I'll tell a lie, but the liaison person we were allotted through that, she earned her money. She was my lifeline in that first probably, you know, 12 months, and one of the very few I had because of COVID. And she was brilliant, and, you know, we were grateful for that, and she did help get us information where she could. She did help source things for us in the way of sending us links for, you know, care for Kelly, for counselling and stuff like that to have a look at. And again, we couldn't access them physically because of COVID. Here's where it gets hard. You know, Kelly came into his teenage years, puberty and all that, just as he lost his brother. We accessed help early on as we could by video, you know, by Zoom. And we did that until he wouldn't. And then as soon as COVID lifted a bit, we tried to access physical counselling. But see, this is the thing with a lot of victims. Counselling isn't the golden ticket early on. I think it's something people have to work towards in their own time. And with young people, some of them are open to it and some of them aren't. And Kelly did try it early on. But he had a bad experience where one counsellor brought up what happened to Angus straight up early in the bit, and he was never going back again. The second time we tried to take him, he was dragging the kitchen table. He had hold of that. He was not going out the door and he was never going again. So what we've tried to do with him now is keep him physically active.
You know, they say that for PTSD, yeah, just like hardcore physical. That's what old coppers and that do.
Yep, keep physically active, because to try and sit and do anything, like even if that's your job to be, you know, dealing with information, you're crushed after this. You just feel like an absolute moron because you can't access like the simplest tasks. You just lock down. Is the only word I can use, you lock down. I do it all the time. I've got stuff that I should have dealt with that, I mean, you know, even our house is just, it looks like something out of a sad movie. Your life stops and what you were doing. But I did try to get physically more active in a way. Ben just tried to get back to being able to work and earn an income. Early on, he just couldn't. And that's what people don't understand. Financially, you'll go backwards because you're just not capable. Your children, like, you know, Kelly, it was his first ever experience of loss, a funeral, and being through COVID. that was another thing that added to it was we were isolated for months and months and months. We couldn't have a funeral that was, you know, only 10 people allowed, and that was including staff. We had a police officer there to make sure nobody tried to attend. We couldn't even sit with the older kids. They had to sit across from us one a pew. They were supposed to touch or hug. And so I had to just, as a mother, I had to sit with my older daughter because, like I said, all the males in the family just couldn't deal with it, couldn't deal. And so me and my oldest daughter, Angus's only sister and big sister, had to organise a beautiful Angus's funeral, you know, and try and compact 15 years of a child into something to read at his funeral. And he hadn't even lived. He hadn't even had a chance to live. You know, it was brutal. It was brutal and it was cruel. And I think I went into autopilot on the day. And the worst part for me, there were so many, but one of the worst parts was watching my older kids grieve and I couldn't comfort them, but watching my 12-year-old son's heart just break. You could physically see his heart break. And the day of the funeral was probably the first time Kelly got to see his brother since he passed. And we actually begged him not to, because, as you know, myself and my daughter thought we were going first just to see how confronting it was going to be. And we came out bawling and begged Kelly not to go in, and, you know, just begged him. And he just wanted to. He just wanted to see his brother. And it was the most cruelest thing. You could hear him screaming, "That's not my brother," from, you know, inside the cremation funeral home. And that was just gut-wrenching. And he has not been the same person since. You know, for 2 years, Kelly wouldn't see any of his friends. He wouldn't leave the house. He couldn't go to school. He tried, but he'd sleep for a week after going for 2 days. It was grueling. And then we couldn't even say Angus's name for months and months. But, yeah, I couldn't leave unless Ben was home or one of the older kids could stay with Kelly. I mean, Elyon, he'd lay in his brother's bed all bundled up in his brother's clothes and wearing his beanie and just curled up on his bed. And, you know, he just looked like a lifeless doll, like, for probably the first, I don't even know how long. Like, he barricaded the bathroom one time and I just found him, like, you know, laying in the bottom of the bath, just like, I thought he was gone, and he just couldn't move or talk. I mean, it takes life away from those living that are left behind. And like I said, he's not the same person. He's very quick now to, like, you know, anxiety. He just got anxiety and things will get a rise out of him quickly because that anxiety is still there. So when he feels better is when he's working with his father, and he's 16 and he's working 5 days a week, you know, labouring out with his father. And that's so sad for me because he's missed out on school. He's missed out on socialising with friends. He's gone straight into adult stuff. And look, it's not the worst thing. It's good that he, you know, we have our own business and he can do that. But it's taken those choices away from him and us. We've just had to go with what works and what we're all capable of. And I think that's what a lot of families find, is that trajectory of their family is just thrown off course, and you're all flying and you're all just trying to grab back onto terra firma and make some sort of semblance of a life when your heart's not really in it. You're trying, you know, for that other person, or just trying to do the best you can. It's a deep notch in someone's life and early formative years. And so they talk about the offenders and what's happened to them. Well, we have to take into account now that we're now not out of the woods with our youngest and with our grandkids on the effect this is going to have on their formative years and their lives. And already with the oldest grandchild, we've seen that have a major effect in where his life, and we fought hard to bring him back round. But he adored his uncle. He adored him. And I think he was scared too, because he thought if somebody can take Angus down, who was so big and fit, and, you know, he was, how is some little small kid going to feel? You know, he was 10 at the time.
It's the childhood version of the anxiety, isn't it? There's all that, the separation anxiety, the fear of what's out there in the world, the sudden understanding that things can happen.
That's exactly right. So they've taken away that lovely little buffer we all have where it can't happen to us, and we all blissfully live unaware that, you know, this could ever possibly happen to us. Yes, it happens to people on the news, but this will never happen to us. And once that's ripped away, you can't go back. You know that is a real, like, it's happened and it could happen again. And I, you know, like I said, with the oldest grandson, he couldn't come to Angus's funeral. And when I still remember on the day, like I said, he was just devastated, and as was Kelly. And I still remember coming in and seeing him. He had his hands up to his face crying in front of the pitch who I'd just sat down that they give you at the funeral home. And he took his hand off and reached out and touched Angus's face, the photo of his face, and just broke down and cried. And so there's this little handprint on the portrait of Angus's. And it just, yeah, like I said, it took away that thing that, you know, he was protected and safe.
You're right. Again, you've raised an issue that we don't hear about, because we're not great at following up with families after violent death. Is the siblings and that the results of the trauma that happens to particularly younger siblings. And you're right. I mean, I've spoken to parents who've mentioned it, who've talked about it a little bit, but yeah, you're not just dealing with the trauma of what happened to Angus that night 4 years ago. You've got constant flare-ups, new things all the time going on with the other members of your family.
Yeah, like I said, it's like there's the epicenter and then there's a continual fallout, and it just goes on forever. For as long as you will not have that person and loved one in your life, that child in your life, there will be things coming from that and effects coming from that. And look, you work actively to combat those things and to, you know, see your family, you know, on more solid ground and feel more emotionally strong. You don't want them suffering. But it is the reality that they do suffer. And these things are underlying daily. Like I remember one of my older boys, he had to go back to work pretty much straight away because, you know, young family to feed. And he would ring me and say, "Mum, I had to leave a job because the owner of the house came in and found me crying on the floor while I was trying to work. You know, I'm broken down." You know, it's just devastating. And a lot of their relationships have ended through this because it's a big thing to be confronted with, and it's too much for a lot of people. And unless you're in it, like, I could never have understood what someone in this situation needed, wholeheartedly needed, and how they were affected if I hadn't gone through it myself. You know, you have an idea, it's a different kind of loss.
It is a different kind, and I use this word, and it's so pathetic, but I can't think of another word to use, but the selfishness involved in homicide. for somebody to take another person's life is so overwhelming, isn't it? That you've lost Angus because somebody else murdered him is so overwhelming.
They could have walked away. They were under no threat. No one wanted to hurt them. They just wanted them to go away. They could have left. And then to sit in court and, like our prosecutor said, you know, as he's saying, oh, they feel so bad. You know, they have so much remorse and you'll be happy to know they're getting a great education. You know, your child can't get an education now. And even more happy to know that one's getting a degree in some sort of physical education. That's just what we want. He's an offender faster and fitter when he comes out on bail, you know. And like our prosecutor said, look, remorse is just a word written on a piece of paper unless you actually mean it. And it is so true. And there is no remorse there. They condemned Angus to lose 70 to 80 years of his whole life. They erased him that night. They cut his life completely short. They had that choice and they took that action and they'd done that. And one of the main offender had actually talked to friends about how he'd wanted to kill someone. He'd wanted to stab someone, experience killing someone. So how much more premeditated could you get than that? And look, you know, it is that thing. Even if I took out emotion away from the fact that they stole from us the rest of our lives with our son, they didn't feel remorse. These are two violent boys. They're not boys now, they're men. And one of those turned 18 last year and they never put him in to adult detention. They didn't even fill out the papers, which I was supposed to do. They had 2 months to do after he turned 18. It never happened. Now, Angus is the main offender, is now sitting there as an adult having turned 18 in December. And he possibly won't be moved over. They're keeping these violent adult offenders in amongst these young people coming into these detention centres. They're either beating up on them or they're influencing them. But these boys, they did not think once, what are we doing here? That's flesh and blood. That's a living person. That's somebody who's got people who love them.
I'm so grateful to you for talking to us, because all of these things we want to talk about, really importantly, I think, is talking about your experience with the justice system as it applies to youth offenders, because we have and we do continue to talk to people who work with youth offenders, and we do have a very sympathetic and empathetic perspective on youth offenders, and I have, and I do talk about my opinion that if we were more supportive of families, we would end up with less violent offenders, and I do believe that. However, two things can be true is something else I believe, and you're not, unfortunately, the first family I've spoken to who've been at the other end of youth offenders. And I said very recently to a lady who works in Queensland, actually, with youth offenders, that while I am sympathetic of people who grow up in terrible situations, and I do understand how it affects people's brain development and how they can grow up with no empathy, but I also said to her, but I'm frightened of them. I'm scared of them in my community. I'm scared. I don't want them around my children. I moved my children out of the school that they were in because I felt it was too violent. And that's why it's so important that you have joined us, and why I really appreciate you joining us to talk about your story, because your son has been the victim. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional. And your family have been and continue to be the victims of children. And I don't expect you to have empathy or sympathy for them.
Oh, look, it's that thing that, yeah, I'm not going to lie, when it comes to the boys that took Angus's life, I have very little compassion there. I mean, As a parent, I'd be lying if I said otherwise. And, you know, I think the public would like to hear that, you know, you're of enough character that you would have an understanding. But I do have an understanding, but there has to be a line where you say, all right, you take a life, you've crossed that line. I have no doubt that if somebody had have intercepted early now, child services, I just think that system itself needs a complete overhaul. You've got kids taken away from minor things, from loving families that are devastated. And you know, then you've got kids left in horrific situations that you just can't even fathom that they would be left in. But here's the thing is, not every child that comes from those horrific backgrounds that suffers through parents with serious addictions problems comes out a criminal, but it is a good indicator that they're not going to have a good start. There's a lot of brilliant kids, a lot of loving kids, a lot of kids that have way more empathy because of what they've been through, because of that situation. And I feel sorry for this generation. They can't even have a stage where they're rat bags in their teens and they get their silly on. And again, it is a community failure, a government failure. They say you can't blame the government, but...
Yeah, because it's a funding failure, so you can.
Yes, yeah. Well, the government sets all these restrictions and they have the purse strings of our taxpayers' money and they have the ability to redirect where this is going. Now, look how quick during COVID they did.
Yeah, that's
now,
right.
You can change laws if you really want it, but the thing is, I'm a bit cynical about why they are letting this run because I think blind Freddie could have redirected this. And like you said, we've got to get in early. If somebody had got in early in these two offenders' lives, it would have changed. But that doesn't take away the part that is their responsibility that they took that action to stab someone. Now, that's next level. And look, it's hard enough to get a sentence to stick. Their slates get wiped clean at 18. And as you've seen, we couldn't even get them put in adult prisons.
And look, I'm on record as saying that I think that's a terrible idea and I want to be transparent with you about that because I've, you know, spoken to adults who that happened to. However, the adults I've spoken to were placed in adult prisons as children for offences like car theft and I wasn't talking to people who had murdered other children.
And see, there is a difference. There is a difference. And look, I've said all along, if we can redirect kids early on, then let's redirect them. Let's, you know, spare lives in any way we can. And so, you know, I'm not against that. I think there is an absolutely ridiculous amount wasted and we need to condense it back. And money is being frittered away that's needed to access help early on. And I say, when I say early on, I'm talking about pre-pregnancy or during pregnancy.
Absolutely.
Rehabilitation of families, young adults. We don't have enough rehabilitation available. And what is there's long waiting lists or it's so expensive. It's not accessible for so many people that, you know, and we leave it till they're ready to beg for help. And sometimes that's too late. You know, the damage is already done. On an end note, if I could say one thing is, let's get on and let's fill a need and get into earlier rehabilitation. Let's, you know, before these kids are born, before they even take their first breath in the world, let's deal with the need that's there now for rehabilitation. I think if we step on that first and if we set the laws up, we're going to have to address the hardcore offenders. And I think if we address them and that new lot coming through see that there is a repercussion for your actions and that it's not a walk in the park, it will act as a deterrent. But then we can come from the back and fill that void with ample help to just redirect them. We need to address this like a disease that's got to be fixed and remedied and cured. We need to look at all these kids, whether they're blonde-haired, blue eyes, whether they've got brown hair and brown skin and brown eyes, whatever. We need to look at them as these are our up-and-coming youth. Don't put them into different categories. Address them the same. If there is a need, let's fill it. If there is help they need to prosper or something we can do to get them on the right track, do it. Youth work is it's a serious gig when you do that. You can influence these kids. I'm not saying it's all on you, but you're another piece of that puzzle. You have a big influence on these kids. We were finding that not all youth workers were of the same quality. Like a lot of them influence them in a negative way. These kids come away feeling resentment and that they're owed something, owed by the public. And then it sort of came to me, well, if they feel like that, no wonder there's no empathy when they kill someone. And we've seen that through everything we've had to view and watch and live through. We've seen the lack of empathy, and they should have to work with 12 months with victims' families before they ever work with young offenders. So they've got balance. And, you know, because you can't know what you haven't experienced. Like you can, you know, learn all of that through tuition and everything else, but it's not the same as actually going into court and experiencing what victims go through and what families live through and seeing the effect. These, you know, it can't just be all compassion, because if you have all the compassion for them but you never actually make them accountable for what they've done, you're not helping them. You're not helping them and you're not helping the families. And so there's a lot of things we need to do to change this, and I appreciate people like yourself, you know, being out there trying to shed light on, you know, the other side of what happens after somebody's life is taken, after an offender, you know, takes that step, makes that decision to take a life that, you know, they didn't have the right to take. He was special, and I say it all the time, he would have been someone amazing, and he really would have. And now we all feel like a bit like, you know, the lost tribe without him.
Thank you to our guest today, Michelle Little. If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732. Or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
As promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you. Update for Brisbane Australian True Crime fans. Brisbane is almost fully sold out for our live show. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well. So, you know, we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian true crime live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.